There's no way I could have put that at the beginning. It would have felt cheesy. It would have felt strange. But because you had all gone on a journey that night, you had done things that were out of your element, you come back together and it's like, whoa, we were strangers just a few hours ago. There was this moment of singing and laughing and like, what just happened? And boom, the night ends.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Famous Failure, as where I interview the world's most interesting people about their failures and what they learn from them. I'm your host, Ozan Barol. Before we begin, we're just 1 week away from the official publication of my new book, Think Like a Rocket Scientist: Simple Strategies You Can Use to Make Giant Leaps in Work and Life. I've been ecstatic about the early reviews. The book is number one on Adam Grant's list of his top 20 books of 2020. It's been called a must read by Susan Cain and endlessly fascinating by Daniel Pink. So the book will come out just 1 week from today. And if you order the book before April 14th, you will get two amazing bonuses. First is a video training with a behind the scenes look at my productivity system. I will reveal some of the productivity secrets that allow me to write Think Like a Rocket Scientist in record time. So you'll find tips on how to defeat procrastination, how to minimize distractions, how to get more done in less time, and so much more. The second bonus is a pack of 10 3-minute bite-sized videos with actionable insights from the book that you can implement right away. So for example, you're going to learn the single principle that Elon Musk used to revolutionize the aerospace industry and how you can use the same principle to revolutionize your life. You will learn about an unstoppable astronaut training strategy that you can use to nail your next presentation or product launch. You will learn the one word you can use to boost your creativity. The use of this word is backed by several research studies, and I personally use it on a weekly basis, both for myself and my team. You can see the full list of videos and find the links to purchase the book at rocketsciencebook.com/podcast. That's rocketsciencebook.com/podcast. Today's guest on the show is Bea Voce. Bea has produced magic touch experiences ranging from two-person rituals to elaborate 1,000-plus person immersive theater productions. Whether 20-person Jeffersonian-style dinners or high-end finance conferences at Lincoln Center and everything in between, Bea's focus is engineering unforgettable moments. With more than 4 million views, her TEDx talk on loneliness is one of the most viewed of all time. She has been featured by Forbes, ABC, Fox, MTV, and South by Southwest for her perspective on experience design and human connection. You can sign up for Bea's email list on her website, which is beavoce.com. That's BAYAVOCE.com. You can also follow her on Instagram, which is at Bea Voce. In the episode, Bea and I discuss how being on the real world Brooklyn flung Bea into a canyon of loneliness. What advice Bea would give her 21-year-old self? The invisible public health crisis Bea is happy to see getting more attention. How feeling alone at gatherings led Bea to a career in experience design. What business event planners get wrong with networking events. How Bea ends up cultivating a high emotional response from her guests in designing experiences. The importance of turning your event into a story. And finally, and this is very timely, what you should think about if you're moving your real world event to a virtual format. As always, every link that we discussed or every resource that we discussed will be linked to in the show notes. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Bea as much as I did. Thank you so much for listening. Bea, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I feel like this has been such a long time in the making.
I know. I'm so glad we could finally connect for what promises to be a very timely and relevant interview. But I want to start by traveling back in time. You were one of the participants in the real world Brooklyn, and in your TEDx talk, which we'll link to in the show notes, it's called The Simple Cure for Loneliness, and it's one of the most viewed TEDx talks of all time with over 4 million views the last time I checked. So you mentioned in the talk that the real world didn't bring you connection like you thought it would. In fact, if anything, you were lonelier than you had ever been. Now, that statement might strike some people as odd because, well, one, you're in New York City, and two, you're living with, you know, what are supposed to be these fascinating individuals who are carefully vetted from all over the United States. Can you talk to us about why you felt so lonely?
Yeah. And, you know, like the period of filming when we were all living together was not the lonely part. Like that was fascinating and incredible and so weird. Like it was such a strange experience to be in this fishbowl and be videotaped. Like there are cameras everywhere following you doing everything. Like what a strange and odd experience that I feel in some ways really fortunate to have had, because so few people get that, like that odd of a life experience, especially I was 21 at the time. It was actually after that that spun me into this kind of fury of loneliness and depression really unexpectedly, because so you're on the show, and while you're on the show, the producers are obsessed with you. They need to know your every move, where you're going, what you're doing. And then meanwhile, there are kind of backstage, you know, there are these conversations with alumni of past Real World people, or there are, you know, we kind of know what can happen after the show and like the opportunities that you can get after the show. And, you know, think back, this was 2008. So it's a long time ago. Reality TV was still really, really big. The Real World was still really big. It was right around the time that Jersey Shore came out. So it was still reality TV was still really big. And the people who were coming off of reality TV shows were becoming celebrities in some circuits, right? Like these D-list celebrities, but celebrities nonetheless. And leading up to being on that show, all I wanted was to be popular. I mean, like my whole life, starting from a very little kid, was like, okay, I see very obviously that I don't fit in. How do I fit in? How do I figure this out? And like basically my entire kind of adolescent life was figuring out how to be popular and fit in and be liked, because in my head, I had made it up that that would then make me feel more connected. I mean, all the things, you know, you would imagine, like the popularity would like solve all the problems. So before the Real World, I had done everything to be popular. I mean, I was like cheerleader, student body president, dance company, choir, you name it. And I remember in junior high, actually having people signing other people's yearbook and saying, I'm going to be on the Real World one day. Like, I'm going to be famous. I had this idea that like Real World meant celebrity famous. So when auditions came and I ended up making it, it was like, this was my chance. This was my chance to be seen. This was my chance to be validated. This was going to be the thing that solved all the problems that I had always been trying to solve. So up until that point, all of the times that I had tried to be really popular and made it, right? Student body president, cheerleader, whatever, I was always kind of on the outskirts. I lived in Utah. I was not Mormon growing up with a bunch of Mormons. So I was like kind of in, but never all the way in. And so the Real World was really this pinnacle where all of a sudden I was like, okay, I'm going to be all the way in. Like, this is going to be the ticket. So meanwhile, we're on the show, we're hearing kind of mumblings about what can happen after, how much money you can make, how you can get managers afterwards, how, you know, you'll be sent to all these clubs, you'll fly all over the nation, you'll like be in the public eye. So behind the scenes, as we're filming, I have all of this like in my mind is like, what's going to happen next? So we get off the show and all of a sudden, it starts happening. I get managers starting to call. But the managers are like pretty skeezy. I mean, you can imagine the kinds of people who are managing reality TV personalities. Like, not the like creme de la creme of management. And all I'm hearing after that show gets over is like, I think it had like a 12-week run and it was like, you're relevant now. You will never be relevant again. Like, this is your chance. Make the most of it. If you don't make the most of it, like the next season is going to air and you're nothing, honey, like nada. And then the producers stop caring about me, right? They don't care about where we are. They don't care about what we're doing. They're editing. They're looking for the next season and who's going to be on the next show. And I found myself, so we filmed in Brooklyn, show wraps. I move into New York City with two of my housemates from The Real World. And one was going into TV and very clear about her, like, this is what she was going to do. She had known that from like day zero coming out the womb, like girlfriend was going to be a TV host. And then the other guy, he was this fitness guy and he was going to start this YouTube fitness channel. And both of them were so focused. They knew exactly what they were going to do. And they were hustling so hard. Meanwhile, I went on the show thinking I was going to be a hip hop dancer. Like, I wanted to be a backup dancer for Snoop Dogg. And when I was on the show, I auditioned for this conservatory, this hip hop dance conservatory. And I just realized I wasn't that good. Like, I was never going to make it as a professional dancer. And so I ended up starting to DJ because I wanted to try something. And I also wanted to be doing something that put me in the limelight. And so I started to DJ, but like, I didn't love it. Like, I wasn't that good, but I was a female DJ, so it was easy to market. So these two are being like, they're so focused, they're hustling, they're doing the thing they know they're going to do. And then here I am changing my mind every 30 seconds about what I'm going to do and who I'm going to be and like what my brand is, and listening to these managers about telling me how I'm not going to be relevant and I have this time frame and if I don't decide now and blah, blah, blah. And I was scared. I felt like, I mean, truly, New York spit me up and chewed me out. Within a year after the show wrapped, I was so depressed. I felt so alone. I was comparing myself to all of my roommates. I had no confidence. I mean, and I looked back at that and just felt like, how did I miss that opportunity? Like, I failed. The thing that I knew since I was a junior high student, like I was going to be on the show and it was going to make me famous. Like, oh shit. It didn't quite happen the way that I thought it was going to go down. And I think just the reality of it, and this isn't really news to anybody, I don't think, but that like the thing outside of myself that I thought was going to give me connection, this validation outside of myself, like surprise, surprise, didn't.
It reminds me of that Jim Carrey quote, right? I wish everybody could be successful and rich and so they can find out that it's not the answer. But of course, what happens, and this has been true over the course of my life too, it's like you hear that and you're like, okay, so this next milestone isn't going to make me happy, or at least these external accolades aren't going to make me happy, but I'm still going to go after them because I want to find out myself what happens. And so you totally externalize your happiness instead of looking to internal factors. And in your case, I'm sure it must have been particularly difficult too. Like, you were in the limelight with The Real World, and then you're living in New York City, one of the densest, more, you know, most connected cities in the world. And I'm sure that feeling of loneliness must have been exacerbated because you probably felt like you shouldn't be lonely.
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, but it was the first time that I had ever needed to think about why people wanted to be my friend or why people wanted to be around me, right? Like, the managers, they didn't care about me. It was like I was a commodity that they were selling. And as long as I was a hot commodity, they wanted to sell me. And the second I wasn't, like, they didn't care. Or why did people want to be friends? Like, I think I remember thinking back to the people who became friends with us on the show. Like, none of those people stayed friends with us after, like, after the show wrapped, you know. I can maybe think of one person who I've stayed in touch with, who I met during the filming of the show, who, you know, is still a dear friend. But it also started to just, I had this kind of innocence going into it, or maybe naivety or whatever you want to call it. And I came out sort of jaded, sort of like asking questions that I had never asked before. And also, I was 21 and felt like I had to have it all figured out because the people around me seemed to. But as I think about it, I'm like, 21, who has it figured out at 21 years old? And I remember I was dating I ended up dating one of the cast members, and he went off on his second deployment after we wrapped. And so he was in Iraq. I was back in New York and decided I didn't want to be with, like, we were just not a match at all. And at this point I was changing my mind about so many things. Was I going to be a dancer? Was I going to be a DJ? Whatever, blah, blah, blah. And I remember, I'll never forget this. He emailed me. I think I had broken up with him over phone or email or whatever. And he emailed me, and the title was, "When the Going Gets Tough, Bea Goes Running." So I had this whole story around my ability to commit to something and to see something through, or what do I actually do in the face of things that are hard? And these questions that at 21, I just didn't have the tools to contemplate. I didn't know how to think about those kind of bigger, more esoteric questions. And so I didn't. Yeah. I was just like, you're wrong, pointing fingers at everybody and then feeling like absolute shit about myself. And by the end of New York, I ended up doing a yoga teacher training to find answers. I took like the last $3,000 in my bank account, did a yoga teacher training, ended up falling for the owner of the yoga studio, who was like, so at this point I'm 22. He's like mid 40s, Rico Suave kind of guy, like has all the words, uses all the like yogic language. And I never dated an older guy. And this is kind of a tangent, so bear with me for a second, but he's this older guy who made me feel seen the way that I wanted to feel seen by doing the show, made me feel special, like the way that I wanted to feel on the show, which the show didn't give me any of that. So now I have this other thing to look at and to think, okay, like, could this be, okay, so it wasn't the real world. Maybe it's this other thing. Maybe it's this guy. And he like wined and dined me, took me all over the city. I fell for him very quickly. And I'll never forget, it was the last week of the teacher training, and this girl was crying, and a couple of girls were around her consoling her. And I ended up coming over and asking what was wrong. And she was like, she was talking about this guy. She's like, you know, I was dating him and I just found out he was dating somebody else.
Oh, wow.
And that somebody else wasn't me, by the way. He was dating like four of us at the same time. And I remember approaching him. I knocked on his door, sobbing, and told him what I had heard. And he looked me in the eye and he said, "Wow, Bea, you just ruined everything that we had. Like, we could have had something so special and you just ruined it." And it was like all of these things, kind of one after another, had me confronted with my own desperation, really, and my own insecurities and my own inability to look inward. And that all left me feeling totally isolated, even though I had friends, even though I was quote unquote popular, even though I had whatever I had, like it didn't really matter. I had never felt so alone in my entire life. And I think the misconception with loneliness is that you need to be physically isolated in order to feel lonely. Mm. Like, I think the loneliest I've ever been has been in crowded rooms or at dinner parties where I don't feel included or I haven't felt like I have something to contribute or the conversation stays shallow or I don't feel like I can, you know, tell the truth about where I'm at or whatever it is. Like, loneliness is not one size fits all by any stretch of the imagination. And we can feel disconnected when we're in relationship. I mean, they're like, I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but like when you're in a fight with your partner and it's like a bad fight and you two get into bed at night and it's completely silent, but it's like the loudest scream you've ever heard. right? In the room.
Yep, totally.
Like, that's loneliness.
That really resonates with me because some of the loneliest periods of my life or the events where I feel the most lonely are these like networking events. I'm an introvert and really can't deal with small talk. Like small talk screeches my ears. That has the same effect as like nails on a chalkboard. And you're in this big room with all of these people and you're expected to schnooze and talk to people and collaborate with them. And it's like, it feels so lonely to me. I just wrote about this actually, but when I was a baby law professor back in 2012, I was at this big event, big law professor conference. And I would just run up to my room every 15 minutes to take a breather. And I had picked up Susan Cain's book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts, yeah, in a World That Can't Stop Talking at the Airport. And so I would run up to my room every like half an hour to just like take a solitary breath and read a few pages from the book before I would go back down. And so, yeah, in my own life as well, the lonelier periods have been in those instances where you're around other people and there's a societal expectation that you should not be lonely for one reason or the other. So if you could travel back in time, what advice would you give to that 21-year-old or 22-year-old Bea?
You know, it may sound kind of cliche because this is the topic at hand right now, but I felt so alone in my loneliness, meaning I didn't realize that what I felt was common. I wish I could tell myself, like, there are other people just like you. Mm. Like, I think we now, like, loneliness is becoming more and more of a hot button topic. You know, people are calling it a public health crisis. I mean, literally the former Surgeon General of the United States he's releasing a book soon about how loneliness is a public health crisis. There are international best-selling books. One is called Lost Connections by Johann Hari. And they're like so poignant about loneliness. And the UK has appointed a minister for loneliness.
Wow.
Loneliness is not new. It's just widely misunderstood. For instance, AARP has done a study that says basically like people over 45 years old, which is nearly like a third of the population, experience loneliness. It's a big number of people who experience loneliness. And I would honestly say most people in their life have experienced loneliness, whether it's significant and affects you on a major level or it's situational. Like, you kind of know what it feels like to be lonely, but it's not really, it hasn't been talked about as something that is this mental health kind of public crisis. And I think now, especially with COVID, we're in a position to really highlight that, like, if you are alone, whether you are living with one person, whether you have roommates, whether you live by yourself, whether you go to parties every night and you're invited to speak on big stages, everybody in these categories experiences what it is like to feel disconnected and isolated. And I just didn't know that. I didn't know that. I thought I was unique in feeling the way that I was feeling.
I heard you mention this on, it may have been a conversation between the two of us or maybe on a different interview, but if you type into Google, why do I feel so ... the pre-filled search results, one of the top two is lonely.
Yeah. If any one of us were to put in, why do I feel so, you would see it's like one of the top three results is alone. And then if you were to enter, why is everyone else so ... you would see in the first three, happy.
Such a disconnect.
But the conversation is becoming more popular, especially with books like these gaining attention. It's more and more people are talking about it more. David Brooks, who is a writer and New York Times contributor, he just recently put out an article in The Atlantic on loneliness about the nuclear family. And I think it's called something like The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake. Same kind of premise. It's just gaining steam, not because of the issue at hand you know, right now we're in COVID days, but because more and more people are talking about it and it's like, this is not new. And I get it's being highlighted right now, but we were feeling lonely way, way before we were locked up in our houses.
So fast forward to today, and now you're working on experience design. Can you tell the listeners what that means exactly and how your own personal experience that you just described when you were 21, 22, feeling so lonely and not knowing that everybody else feels the same way, how that informs what you're doing now?
Yeah. So now what I do is I both create experiences, and I did that more in the past like decade or so, but more recently I basically come into events and I doctor them. So if, for instance, you have seen a movie called Hitch with Will Smith, he's this date doctor and he takes these good guys who have all the raw materials, like make a great partner, and he just gives them the tools and the know-how to actually get the girl. So I kind of think of myself in that way. Like I come in and I take a good event and I give the event the tools, the know-how to make that event great. And I do that by creating two things: unexpected moments and high emotional responses. So I call it HER. And the reason I got into this period is because like my loneliness, especially as somebody who was like invited to whatever parties and the clubs and the like, I knew gathering is a place that people feel really lonely. And I think you're right on. Like most people who are interesting talk about networking events and like never, ever want to step there. Like never again do they ever need to go to a networking event. Yeah. But what's happened with events is we've used this kind of stale formula that doesn't work to actually make us feel connected to one another. So the networking event is a perfect example. You walk into a room, you get your name tag, you're supposed to like have a combo with the person next to you. So you're trying to make small talk, but like you know the guy selling you insurance is not the guy you want to be talking to. So you beeline for the bar and try and make small talk at the bar, and you already have a drink, but you don't really know what else to do. So, you know, it's such a bad model. And what we have been taught to do as event organizers and as businesses is focus on the what: the venue, the lighting, the speakers, the farm to table, chef inspired dinner. But that's actually not A, what makes us feel connected, and B, what makes an event memorable. We remember moments. Like if you've ever been unexpectedly dumped, like you remember that moment. Like you will never forget the moment that your, you know, then partner walked in and was like, sorry, you're not my person. I don't know why, I just can't get there, or whatever it is. Like you'll never forget that moment. Yeah. We remember our lives and moments, and the experience we have been taught to focus on, the what, the things that I just pointed out, those are not ever going to be what makes your event memorable. And they're not going to be the thing that makes somebody walk away feeling touched, moved, and inspired to change. So I feel like gatherings, events, they need a facelift. They've needed a facelift for a really long time. And I want to be part of making gatherings better.
I'd love to jump in with a personal story here of an event that was planned by Bea Voce, which is first time I met you, Bea. So this was in Salt Lake City. It was a New Year's Eve event. So this would have been New Year's Eve
2018 going on to 19.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we were given no instructions aside from you have to show up in Salt Lake City, and we did. And an hour before the meeting time, we got an email or a text saying we're supposed to go to this cemetery in the middle of nowhere, and it's freezing cold outside. And especially for the ladies, you know, they're wearing skirts and high heels, but even for the gentlemen, it was so cold, and we were asked to dress up as one of our alter egos, and we showed up at this cemetery, and again, just going back to what you were talking about, Bea, unexpected moments. I mean, I will never forget that. And then people walking in with cloaks and animal masks and a boombox. And someone pressed play on the boombox, and it was your voice with instructions. And then we had to go to whichever animal mask resonated with us or appealed to us most. And then the party all started there. And and that moment, I will never forget that. And that's the moment that I describe to people when I'm like, oh, I went to this interesting New Year's Eve party. And then they assume I was just like a club with open bar. No, it was nothing like that. It was so wildly unexpected. And the consequence of that, too. So not only does that moment stand out in my life, but the friendships I made at that one event, right? This was a New Year's Eve event, and then there was a brunch the next day. But we traveled to Finland with a lot of those people. Like every time Dave comes up to Portland, we have dinner. And so some of the best friends I've made in the past 2 years have been from that one evening.
Oh, that makes me, I have a shit eating grin on my face right now. Like I am so happy to hear it. Like that is why I do what I do, to hear stories like that. And what happens when you create unexpected moments for people, especially like that, right? So basically what I did was I dumped everybody into a situation where they were immediately uncomfortable. And the reason I did that is because, you know, unbeknownst to the attendees, I immediately created psychological safety because everybody was in it together. It was like, okay, there's no getting around. We're all freezing cold. Like, even if you know somebody there, everybody is like, what are we doing? Everybody has the same level of confusion. Nobody knows what's happening next, which completely evens the playing field. And what I did when I had you split up into groups with the masks, one of the instructions was do not go to a group where you know somebody. Split up with the people that you came with. So automatically, you're in a position where you meet somebody new. The other thing I did, and I want to just kind of run through this a bit, just so for anybody who's hosting an event, you can kind of dissect why I did these things and do it for your event. So I split people up immediately. I had them in uncomfortable positions and in these unexpected moments, right? And then the entire event was curated and facilitated because for people like you, and I think this is so important, in the back of my head, I'm always thinking, how can this event work for the biggest introvert in the room? And when you do that, you cannot get lazy, because often what we'll do is we'll host a dinner and again, we'll focus on the what, the food, the spread, the, you know, what charcuterie, whatever it is. And we forget to create dialogue. Like we forget what's actually happening during the dinner, but that's the most important part, because you can serve the best meal you can possibly imagine with the top chef. And if there is not great conversation, people might remember it for a little while. They might talk to their friends about it for a little while, but it will eventually be forgettable.
Yeah. People are not going to remember the floral arrangements at a wedding, but it's going to be the unexpected moments that you create.
Absolutely. And also, it's so important to have these moments throughout the event, but it's most important to open and close with these moments, because these are the moments that it's a psychological principle. It's the recency effect and the primacy effect. Yeah. And yeah, recency and primacy. And which just goes, it's just basically, we remember the things that happen at the beginning and we remember the things that happen at the end. Which is why, by the way, if you have ever broken up, and I'll just go back to this because we were talking about it before. If you've ever broken up and it was a good breakup, like you're way more likely to look back at that relationship fondly. Mm-hmm. But even if the relationship was actually like pretty good and you go through a really bad breakup, you will find all of the things that are wrong with that. Like you will hold that perception about the relationship, or you're more likely to hold a negative perception of the relationship if it ended poorly. So I think about this with events too. Start off really strong, something unexpected, and then end with something really strong. We're used to ending with thank yous, and the thank yous are really for the host. And it's like, we need to thank people. I get it. It's really important to thank the staff and thank the talent and all those things, but don't end there because that's forgettable. That's no one remembers that. And so at this event specifically, I'm always thinking about taking attendees through a journey. I like to look at it like an arc, like the hero's journey. But at the end of the journey, like they had gone through all of these experiences based off of their alter ego. And like the whole experience was meant to bring a sense of camaraderie within the group. And so by the end, there was somebody playing piano. We all came back to the same room. And do you remember what happened here?
Everybody started singing along.
Yeah, like arms around each other, singing along. And the reason that works, like there's no way I could have put that at the beginning. Like it would not have worked. It would have felt cheesy. It would have felt strange. But because you had all gone on a journey that night, you had been split up, you had done things that were out of your element, you come back together and it's like, whoa, we just did that. And like, here we are. We were strangers just a few hours ago. And so there was this moment of like singing and laughing and like, what just happened? And boom, the night ends.
So true. And I will never forget that moment either. And then there was brunch the next day, which was a great, great period of time to go back and reconnect with each other, you know, with these friends you made the night before in a more sort of low stakes environment. We're coming to the end of our time here, but I do want to ask one more question because I know this is very, very topical. And so you talked about creating these unexpected moments, these what you call HER, the high emotional response, which I think a lot of people will look at that and say, well, that's doable when you're holding these in-person events. But what about virtual events? And especially since a lot of these in-person events are now being canceled and some conferences are just canceling them, period. Others are trying to move some of their events online to a virtual format. What should businesses, conferences be thinking about in terms of creating engagement in a virtual setting?
What I want to point to first is that events and the formulas that we have been using, which is what I've been talking about with the what, they haven't been working anyhow. So I actually think the move to online virtual events gives us this incredible opportunity to rethink how we can do events differently because they weren't working. Like the majority of events were not working the way they were being done. We're using models that just do not get us what we want, which is meaning. Like we all just want to find meaning. Gatherings give us meaning, or they at least have a huge opportunity to do that. So as we move our events online, what I would suggest is to start thinking differently about everything. Like trash every model that you've ever seen or have thought to do or have done and start from the beginning. So here is a way that I like to think about it. Like I said, I use the hero's journey a lot, which is somebody enters the space, some big things happen, and then they exit the space a new person or the same person with new perspective. And in order to do this, you need to be creating an experience that is really engaging. So as you're creating your experience, be thinking not so much, okay, how do I get people to stay engaged, but how do I create an experience such that even if somebody is on their phone, even if their tabs are open, they cannot help but be like transported back to what I am teaching them. There are a few keys to doing this. One is online, we just have a shorter attention span. So first and foremost, if you're doing like a really long, you know, whether it's 1 day or 5 days event, cut the time. So if it was 8 to 6, make it from 9 to 4. And instead of say do like 90 minute speakers or so, you really want to max out the time at about 50 minutes of somebody speaking. And then you always want to give people ways to engage. So at the beginning, when people are coming onto the event, I highly suggest having people on video with you because it makes them engage in a way that they don't need to otherwise, and they just can't otherwise. So if you make sure everybody is on video and then you give them ways to engage, so you can say, all right, what's the thing you're most excited about learning today? Type it in the chat box. Okay, everybody on the count of three, unmute yourselves and say like, welcome to the event or whatever. I mean, that was a terrible example, but you know, like say something out loud together. Definitely be using the breakout functions, but there are actually ways to like the, Here's an example. Networking, for instance. Networking events didn't work before. So how do you create that experience in a way that actually works online? Well, one way you could do it is create some sort of like concierge introduction service. So you create a Facebook group, either you or your staff member gets on and somehow creates facilitated introductions for people. Maybe it's based off of their specific industry. Maybe it's based off of monthly income, whatever it is, depending on the theme or the purpose of your event. But you can actually create better introductions a lot of times online than you can in person if you're doing one of these like the networking events that we really dislike. Another way to do this is to be using the breakout room function on Zoom. It's so good. I have been attending, I can't even tell you how many online events over the last basically month since this has all gone down, and watching what people are doing well and what people are doing not so well. The people who use the breakout functions are like by far and away the events that have more overall engagement. And what I'm hearing from feedback from attendees is that actually the breakout rooms allow them to meet way more people and go deeper more quickly. Because you can imagine going to an event and like you're kind of just drawn to the people that you know, and you'll probably eat with the same people and, you know, go to the after party with the same people or cocktail hour or whatever. But these breakout rooms become a forcing function to meet different people. It's tricky to say, here's what you do online, here's the formula that works, and this is like what you need to do to make an online event successful. I actually feel like anybody who's doing that is like selling you a lie. What so many events are missing, live or virtual, is getting to their purpose before they plan the event. Because all the things I'm telling you, these are just tools to use that help you create like a virtual event, period. You could probably find any of the tools that I'm telling you online on a webinar or in a blog post. But what most people are missing and what most people don't do that actually helps you stand out from the crowd and helps you decide which moments to put in that create the high emotional response is to define your purpose before you start planning the event. Because once you know why you are gathering, then all of a sudden, every component that you put in, from the people you invite, to the speakers you choose, to the activities you do, to the question prompts you use, everything will be pushing the story forward. So everything that you do, if you use your purpose and base all of the deciding factors of the speaker and all of that based on your purpose, if you do that, then you move the story forward in a way that actually has a through line like a movie. And then it becomes a story. Your entire event becomes a story and the plot is your purpose.
I love that. And there are two things that I want to highlight there. One is the idea that there is no formula, no script you can follow for these online events, and that really the purpose will give you direction on what you should be doing. That's so true, because the formula and copying and pasting of the formula is what gave us the stale networking event, right? It's like people totally are taking that and then just copying it. And now we're in this moment where the status quo has been disrupted, whether we like it or not, but that gives event planners an opportunity to, as you said, question everything that they do. So get rid of all of the assumptions, go back to first principles, and their first principles meaning define the purpose of the event and let that dictate everything else you do. And on that point too, there's a great book called, I think it's The Art of Gathering, right, by Priya Parker.
Priya Parker, so good.
Which is really a great resource as well. And Bea, if people want to get in touch with you to potentially work with you in designing their events or adding that wow factor, the unexpected moments, how can they get in touch with you?
You can find me online on my website at beavoce.com, or I'm on Instagram, Bea_Voce.
And you mentioned you'd be starting an email list as well. How can people join that?
Yeah. So you can just go to my homepage, bayavoce.com, BAYAVOCE.com, and it will be there. And right now I'm still deciding on what that email list is going to be, but it will be tips on how to be making your event better. And it may be reviews of other people's events and what worked and doesn't work and why, so that you can start to see what are people doing? What are the similarities of, you know, that work and what doesn't. And so that's going to be the basis of what I'll be either talking about via the written word or video, which seems to be my preferred format.
Awesome. Well, we'll put all of that in the show notes. Bea, it's always such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.